Thank you for joining us. My name is Nathan Jones. I'm a partner at Andreessen Horowitz. We are an early stage venture capital firm based in Silicon Valley. Just to give you some quick background on us before I introduce our speakers to go through their presentations. We're about 5 years old. We've got about $5 billion under management. And we started about 6 years ago with the theory that software is eating the world, fundamentally that every industry is being transformed as we know it due to three kind of trends that we see intersecting. One being that the cost of compute has gone down dramatically in the last 10 years to a point where it's at a consumer level now. The other trend being that developer productivity tools and knowledge sharing has increased exponentially. And then the third being that there's a fundamental shift in market size due to mobile phones, mobile devices, of which we see creating almost 800 million new users of the internet in the next decade. And so when you combine these three trends, we see there being a large opportunity and also a large threat to many, many industries out there. And so on a daily basis in my role at Andreessen Horowitz, I help to advise our corporate clients, which are executives from many industries in corporate America and also in EDU and in government on what these trends are and how they're going to impact their industries specifically. And so along those lines, we want to get into and continue the theme of machine learning and what we kind of think about machine learning. And so if you rewind back about 10 years ago, big data was kind of the in vogue buzzword and project du jour of many IT shops. And there was a lot of budget being put towards big data projects. But then the question arose, now that we've got all this data, what do we do with all of this data? How do we make this data valuable? And since then, we've kind of seen now there have been some new disciplines that have emerged, such as machine learning, that have kind of become an answer to that question. And so fundamentally, you see machine learning now speeding up the answers that executives can get out of this data and speeding up the feedback loop they have between them and their customers if they face customers directly. And so along those lines, we've bought two companies with us, Crix Finn, who's the head of product, VP of product at a company called SigOpt, and also Roger Dickey, who's the CEO of a company called Gigster. Both of these companies, in their own way, implement machine learning to help their clients. And I'll let them start off the presentation by explaining how. And so we'll start off with Crix.
Great. Sasan, can people hear me? Thanks, Nate. My name is Crix. I'm the director of product at SigOpt, and we're actually one of these developer tools that Nate was talking about. So I think I just want to actually just pull the audience a little bit to sort of try and calibrate a little bit on how I want to talk about machine learning today. So who here has heard of AI or machine learning? Who would say you could explain what machine learning is to like a teenager, like a smart teenager? Okay, sure, cool. And then hopefully after this talk, you'll be able to do that. And who here has actually seen or done something with a machine learning model like in their business? Cool, awesome. And then who here has personally trained a machine learning model themselves? Wow, awesome, great. Okay, so we have some, clearly of course Todd from Netflix has. But I sort of have three goals for the talk today. So goal one is to actually give that introduction to machine learning, sort of how I see it, so folks can kind of understand what we're really talking about when we mean machine learning and AI. Goal two is to sort of give just a snapshot of what we see as sort of the state of the art in the industry. And then goal three is to tell you guys a little bit about SigOpt, so I'll apologize in advance for the sales pitch at the end. But I'll tell you a bit about myself, and then we'll go into those sections. So I came to SigOpt from Optimizely and from Google. I worked on AdWords and was sort of introduced to machine learning, doing product management for AdWords and AdSense on mobile devices about 5 to 10 years ago. Google was actually the first company to deploy a machine learning model in production. It was something called SmartAss, which stood for Smart Ad Serving System, which actually got deployed in 2005, I believe, to help rank the ads that you see when you search. And this was a huge boon for Google's business. It generated literally billions of dollars because Google could start to actually predict what ads are most likely to be clicked on. Like, We all know what this is today, but 10 years ago, that was something that was pretty unusual. And so that was kind of where I was introduced to the power of machine learning, and really what I believe is going to drive, you know, most software in the next epoch. So let's talk about just a very short history of machine learning. So Wikipedia describes machine learning as, quote, I've got it here, a class of algorithms that can learn and make predictions from data. So, okay, that's actually not that complicated, right? This is really not a new idea. Who has ever done a regression in Excel? Yeah, right. Okay, so a lot more people. That's actually kind of the original question that led to these new techniques was, what can we do if we have 1,000 data points? Well, you can do a regression in Excel. So, you know, let's say that you have, I think we were talking about in the last panel, you know, the difficulty of predicting, you know, how well a movie's going to do on an opening weekend, right? That's a very difficult problem. But, you know, if I were to take a very first stab at that, I would probably say, okay, can we get some historical data for, well, you know, which weekends have been the best, right? You can get, you know, a couple thousand data points over weekends and try and, you know, predict what weekend was actually going to be the best weekend for this movie. And you might do something, it probably looks something like this, right? And you kind of just go and make a regression and do the best thing you can do. This is a pretty simple idea, obviously. We have sort of the math version of this is that you have an input variable and then you have some prediction. Very simple one-dimensional model. And you know, you might say to yourself, okay, cool, this was pretty good, but really didn't get me what I wanted, which is to know how well that movie's going to do on that opening weekend. So you might try and extend this, right? Okay, well, can we split this up by category of movie? Can we split this up by season? Can we split this up by geography, or you know, whether it's an IMAX movie or not? And you know, maybe you want to get even further and say, okay, you know, can we predict how well the movie's going to do better if Brad Pitt's in the movie, right? And then maybe you have some you know, comparables that you can kind of start to build a more complex regression on. And, you know, pretty soon your, you know, 1,000 data points isn't going to work because there's too many factors and you're not going to actually be able to make a good prediction with all those additional inputs. It's the predictions you make are going to be inaccurate because you don't have enough granularity in the data. So what can we do if we have 1,000,000 data points? So this is where, like, machine learning today, I think, where most production systems are, they use millions to tens, hundreds of millions of data points to try and make this prediction. But the idea is the same, right? We're just trying to say how much will that movie make on that given weekend. So, you know, we know that like Netflix and Amazon are doing this, right? Large scale recommendation systems are based, you know, fundamentally on similar math to doing, you know, instead of a linear regression, maybe you're doing a logistic regression or something. This is not new to anyone. We all know that you know, Netflix shows different movies to different people, and they do it using you know, hundreds of millions of data points to do that kind of very granular prediction. So when you start to, there's another sort of class, sorry, of machine learning model that can be built, which is called a classification model. So rather than just trying to predict how much money I'm going to make on that movie, maybe I can actually start to look at my, you know, library or something and say, without knowing anything, what categories this fall into. You know, is this a horror film or an action film, whatever. Again, this is not really all that complicated of an idea, but here we go, input variables, and then you have some classification, which is actually drawing that line around the red and the green dots. So these are the things that actually machine learning models are trying to do. Sorry if that was sort of review for folks, but where it gets interesting is, what can we do with 1,000,000,000 data points? So this is kind of where modern machine learning and deep learning in particular is starting to actually take off. And this is really driven by the same thing that Nate was talking about, which is that like exponential drop in compute cost and the exponential rise in the quantity of data. And when you put that together, you can start to actually build models that have billions of data points informing them. Again, at the end of the day, you're still trying to do the same things. You're trying to create a regression, trying to create a classification. So, sorry. One thing you can do with 1,000,000,000 data points is pull cats out of images. So there's a famous study done in 2012 by a guy named Andrew Ng at Stanford, who now is actually the head of research for Baidu, where he pulled cats out of YouTube videos, right? And What was amazing about this is he used something called a neural net, which was developed, math was developed like way back in the 70s, and everyone said that AI was going to take over and it would be 5 years until we had a general purpose computer capable of doing what a human could do. That didn't happen because it didn't, the scale of the data and the cost of the compute were way too high at the time. But now it's happening. And Ring built this deep learning neural net model that could actually pull cats out of YouTube videos without ever being told what a cat looks like. And Google now actually has implemented a similar thing inside of Google Photos, where they can show you the photos of the cats, even though they've never actually like seen these cats. These are actually my family's cats. And they're being identified from my photo library. So that's like kind of crazy. And the really cool thing about this is where the data points are actually coming from. The way this works is that these images, which are composed of millions of pixels each, are actually being decomposed, and the inputs into the model, rather than being, you know, traditional structured data like you know, drives sort of most modern recommendation systems, where you have, oh, you know, I'm Crix, you know, I watched this movie, it has this ID, okay, wait, maybe we can use that to predict what the next movie I'm going to watch is. This is unstructured. It's just looking at the actual raw pixels, each as a data point, and then using that to kind of create structure. And that's what deep learning can do, and that's what, you know, I think is really going to drive that next generation of applications. So a couple other examples of this. Golden Gate Bridge, right? Google's never been told what the Golden Gate Bridge actually looks like. It just has a set of images that it knows has the Golden Gate Bridge in it. And from those images, it's actually learned what the Golden Gate Bridge can look like, and actually a number of different sort of angles and, you know, lighting conditions and stuff like this. So it's pretty crazy. Can also start to identify things that are even higher level, like selfie. So these are a bunch of selfies of me and my girlfriend, pardon the images. But you can see that, you know, there's not really any particular pattern here other than that it's a bunch of humans taking a selfie. So I actually don't know how this is working, but that neural net has figured out that, okay, humans maybe on the side of the frame, maybe cut off at the chest, are actually things that cause an image to be a selfie. And again, this is done without any sort of human interaction. So that's like, I think it's pretty cool. I think that I'm not an expert in the entertainment industry. I think it's been really interesting sort of hearing all the panels today. But if I were to hazard a guess, I think that this sort of kind of automatic semantic mapping of content is a pretty interesting thing. We were talking earlier today about the Kevin Spacey moment when he strangles the dog at the beginning of House of Cards and how that actually, you know, turns a lot of people off, but also creates an amazing signal for Netflix, potentially, of who actually is going to keep watching that show. I'm a House of Cards fan. And I think that it's actually going to be possible in the next few years to build neural nets that can actually track sort of emotions through a show and actually feed that back into marketing, into these other sort of data loops that people have been talking about. So that's pretty interesting. Here's a picture of a neural net. It's a little more complicated than that regression in Excel. I don't really have time to do a crash course on neural nets in this talk, but you know, very short version is that neural nets are composed up of these neurons that sort of model after the human brain, that they kind of learn structure through a number of iterations. So the neural net will try something, and it gets told, okay, yes or no, that actually was close to the cat or far from the cat. And over time, over sometimes thousands of iterations, it learns that structure through the sort of signals passing between these different neurons. There is some intuition here. If you're doing like an image recognition problem, that first layer of neurons is actually going to you know, find those edges in those pixels. You know, is this a straight edge or a flat edge or a curving edge? The second layer might find shapes like a circle or a square out of a couple different edges. And then the third layer might start to identify you know, like a head or something, which is composed of several different shapes. But it's tricky, it's hard, and you know, not very many companies are actually doing this because these neural nets are so hard to actually build, despite their power. You can see, though, that the underlying problem here is the same. We're still trying to classify these dots. In this case, they're orange and blue dots. So here's another picture of a neural net. This is a relatively simple neural net. It has three layers and about, I think, 10 neurons in each layer. This is something that is also comes up, I think, from the last panel that's kind of worth noting. which is that these models, as they get more complicated, get harder and harder to explain. And I, for one, actually believe that that's okay. When I used to work at Google, our head of ads engineering used to joke that we were world class at creating models that we didn't understand. But what we did have is we had very, very, very good metrics, that we had very good statisticians who had developed, and we knew that if the model could actually improve the performance on a certain metric, we were happy with that, and that was going to have a good business result. So I think that's actually going to be a big challenge for a lot of industry and a lot of companies. We've seen this, that having a metric that you trust is so important, because if you can trust the metric, then you can do crazy things like building a neural net, and if it makes the metric go up, it's okay, even if you don't actually know how that neural net is working underneath. That's not to say these things are totally infallible. I love this example of trying to classify chihuahuas and ending up with a bunch of blueberry muffins. You can sort of see how that's actually something that one of these neural nets would trip up on, or something even a human might trip up on. But, you know, suffice to say that this stuff is coming, and it's going to get better, and we'll get past this.
Or chihuahuas named Muffin.
Yeah, totally. People probably heard that a neural net beat the world champion in Go, Lisa Dole. Google DeepMind built this. This was back in February. They trained on, you know, couple hundred million Go moves that have ever been made. One thing that I think is important to realize here is that I don't think there's going to be an AI apocalypse where all the, you know, Skynet takes over. But Lee Sedol actually did say that he had learned from watching AlphaGo strategies, right? And I think that's a pretty neat thing, right? Is that the model was actually able to, you know, uncover basically an insight that the world champion Go player had never actually seen. So he feels his game improved, which I think is really neat. This is another Google DeepMind thing. This is a neural net learning to play a video game. So this is, you know, reminiscent of like Doom. But basically the inputs here that the model is getting are, again, just the pixels. It doesn't actually know where it is in the game. It doesn't have a map. It doesn't have access to the physics engine like a normal bot would have. But it's actually learning how to move around. It kind of hits the wall. It turns around. It's really like a baby would kind of learn to crawl around a space. And it gets a reward when it gets one of those apples. And so it knows that if it keeps doing those things, it gets a reward. It'll do better, and it learns to move around. So that's pretty crazy. I mean, neural nets are being used to build self-driving cars. They're being used to solve the Tower of Babel. If anybody hasn't downloaded the latest Google Translate app, I think you should, because you can hold it up and speak in English. It'll translate it into Chinese, and then it's also listening in Chinese, so the person that you're trying to speak with can just speak back into it, and it'll translate it back. It's only maybe 60-70% accurate right now, but that'll go up, and that's pretty incredible, and it will get into your ear, I think, in the next couple years. Like I said, I'm not really an expert in the entertainment industry, but if I were to hazard a guess, I would guess that Pixar is building neural nets right now to try and create natural-looking biped movement, right? We've been doing a lot of motion capture stuff, right? But we have tons of videos of humans in the world, and it wouldn't be beyond the state of the art right now, I think, to put all the videos of humans ever moving against a neural net and use that to create a realistic kind of animated human moving around. So that's something that I kind of look forward to, I guess. One last little fun sort of neural net example, which is actually maybe the most important, is that Google now is actually getting a 15% reduction in power usage in their data centers because of one of the DeepMind neural nets. Rather than just like looking at, you know, which air conditioners to turn on, it's actually looking at the weather. It's looking at all these sort of unstructured pieces of data that do affect that heating and cooling in Google's data centers. And the thermodynamics here are like crazy, like they're kind of unknowable almost, right? It's something that no set of rules or heuristics in a sort of traditional piece of software, could ever model. I think back to that original problem that I posed of doing a regression to try and figure out how much box office returns a certain movie is going to have, and you know, really the reality, of course, is that how well that movie's going to do on opening weekend is more like the thermodynamics of this data center than it is like that Excel regression. And so I think over time, we should expect that our predictive models are going to get that much better because they're going to be actually able to pull in all the unstructured data that now exists. So That's the 12-minute version of where machine learning is and where it's going. I'll just quickly talk about SIGOPT. SIGOPT is a tool to sort of make it easier to build neural nets and complex models. What we do is we kind of plug in on top. This neural net actually has 22 different dimensions of decisions you have to make before you can even train the model, before you've even collected your data, actually. These things are called hyperparameters. And I think one of the reasons that we don't see a lot of pickup is because you have to have someone that knows what to do and which activation function to pick on your neurons. So what we do is we kind of act as that expert guide to sort of turn the knobs on your models the same way you would turn your knob on a car engine. We kind of plug in on top with a bunch of different API integrations, let you improve your models, you send that back to us, and then we're doing our own set of machine learning things, kind of AI for AI, to actually improve those models over time and make them better. And we actually believe that machine learning is something that is going to be important to every business that operates at any sort of scale and is not something you should be outsourcing. I think this is also something that came up on one of the earlier panels. And so what we think is we can just help people get to better models faster with fewer people, fewer data scientists, and make those data scientists more productive, rather than, I think, a lot of what the sort of machine learning software industry would tell you, which is like, oh, well, we're the experts at building the predictive model. Send us all your data. We'll spit back out predictions for you. I don't think that's actually going to be something that is going to be successful. So that's at least our belief at SIGOPT. Very quickly, this is kind of like climbing a mountain in the fog. You're trying to turn the knobs on this model. And what we do is we have this sort of very deliberate version of climbing this mountain. Rather than laying down a grid, which is a classic thing to do here, where you exhaustively try all the possible models, use up a bunch of compute resources, or you just try random points, which is actually popular with neural nets, we sort of provide that optimal learning approach with an ensemble of models on our end that kind of reflect the state of the art of this particular part of machine learning to get you to that best model as fast as you can possibly get. This helps with image recognition, like I was talking about earlier. We can actually outperform these conventional techniques by sometimes 3 or 4x in terms of cost and then even actual model performance as well. This also works in other industries like finance. I think actually the many of our customers are algorithmic trading hedge funds, and this actually is probably the closest thing to actually predicting how well a movie is going to do. You have a lot of time series data. You're trying to essentially predict the market response to something the same way a hedge fund would try to predict the market response to a security. And some of our algorithmic hedge fund customers can get huge returns because of those optimized models much, much faster than they could do with sort of the former expert way. So that's SIGOPT. But more importantly, I think I'm excited to learn more about how the entertainment industry is moving forward. Clearly, folks like Netflix are out in front, but I'm excited to see where machine learning can take entertainment, both from a business perspective and honestly from a creative perspective. I agree with what's been said that you can't have the model do the creative work, but I think having it inform the creative work is going to lead to some pretty interesting stuff. So thanks a lot. I think we have time for questions in the breakout, so I think I'll just hand it right on over to Roger.
Thanks, Crick.
Yeah.
Yep. Now we'll hear from Roger Dickey. He's the CEO of Gigster.
Hey, everyone. So today I'm gonna go a little bit higher level from sort of the recent talk about data and machine learning and talk about one possible application of machine learning towards transforming how work is done. So the aim of this talk is to give you sort of a high level peek into the future of how knowledge workers, so it could be technologists, lawyers, accountants, whatever, how knowledge workers will work in the future more efficiently and more reliably. So at Gigster, we believe that if outsourcing just worked, everyone would use it. So if you could get a technologist on demand, a lawyer on demand, whatever it is, it would be something that everyone would want to use. So the challenge that we've set for ourselves is how do we build this black box where you put in money, you put in a business need, and you get out fantastic knowledge work. And some companies will always want to have in-house professionals, and you'll definitely need that in a lot of cases. But many companies will want to outsource, so we're focused on kind of optimizing that application. So at Gigster, we've built essentially. What we've tried to build is the shortest path from an idea or a business need to a finished product. So the aim is you can push a button, tell us what you want, and you get software. Or in the future, for other fields, you could imagine push a button to file a lawsuit, push a button to do your taxes, or push a button to get blueprints from an architect. And we believe that each of these is optimizable using machine learning and artificial intelligence. So what happens when you make it this easy? Right now, the size of the professional services market is $1.7 trillion. So this includes a lot of the fields I mentioned right now. And this is what you could call outsourcing, or it's the idea of businesses paying for professional services from other businesses. So this includes, as I said, technologists, accountants, et cetera. We believe that if you make it this easy, you actually grow the market for work. You grow the market for professional services by a pretty tremendous amount. Our approach right now to build this sort of platform of the future, you could say, is to combine freelancers with artificial intelligence-based tools. So why freelancers? Well, you can't manage full-time employees the same way that you can manage freelancers, right? You look at a solution like Uber. With Uber, if I want to order a car, I push a button, a car shows up 2 minutes later, right? Uber drivers work for a box in their pocket. They work for their phone, right? So the middle manager has essentially been cut out of this process, and they can do transactional work. They can stop whenever they want. They can pull over, take a break, go grab some food. So work is changing. Work is becoming more transactional, and we believe that to optimize work requires a different type of talent, freelance talent. But over time, and we believe about 10 years to 15 years could be the midpoint, you'll see artificial intelligence-based tools start to augment freelancers enough so that, essentially start to augment freelancers enough to replace about half of what they're doing. So imagine a graph of different tasks. So you can see, this could be any sort of knowledge work project. So I have a planning, a design, and a build phase. So imagine I'm building, I could be making a movie, I could be building a mobile application or a website. The blue nodes are people. So today, individual tasks are done by people, everything's done by people, right? Over time, you start to replace more and more of these with machines as computers start to see how humans do tasks, and you go from thousands of data points to millions of data points to billions of data points for individual tasks. You start to replace these with machines, and then eventually, maybe for certain types of knowledge work, you can replace almost every micro task that has to be done with a computer. So here's an example interface for the worker of the future. So my name is John A., and I've made $1,400 today, and you can see that, let's say I'm a project manager for a software development project. So the machine, the framework here is the machine is actually doing the work, and I'm assisting the machine. So I can see the backend developer called in sick. What should we do? The computer doesn't have an answer. So this would be a node on the diagram that would still be colored blue. So I can say, well, tell the client that we'll be late, or let's replace the developer, or let's do nothing for now. Let's just wait, and maybe the developer gets better, and we didn't have to tell the client anything, right? So I complete that card. I make some money. Which feature should the developer build first, login or profile pages? The computer's not sure, right? The work system isn't sure, so I have to tell the computer. Next time it sees this, or after 100 different humans have answered this question the same way, then the computer can do this. Next, this is a piece of natural language the computer's not able to process. Perhaps the computer thinks there's sarcasm present, or it isn't sure it can read the tone. So the person said, I don't like the checkout flow. Can you show a preview of items next to each line in the receipt? So this is probably an e-commerce website where I want to see a preview of a few items. Well, who should I route this request to? Well, it turns out both the developers and the designers have to view this request. So maybe as a project manager, I can do that request routing. So again, why freelancers? And is it plausible to build this out of freelancers? The answer is yes. By 2025, 50% of Americans, in some form or fashion, will have a presence in the freelance economy. And what kind of response have we gotten from the system so far? Well, there are a lot of freelance systems out there already. There's, Odesk, Elance, Freelancer.com, Guru. There's a lot of places that you can go hire a freelancer. But when I founded this business with my co-founder, we asked ourselves the question, if we want to make extra money, what do we do, right? We're not going to, necessarily want to go drive an Uber around, and we don't want to be on freelancer.com because then we get managed by strangers online, we get paid late, we sort of don't get to be part of an interesting team or do interesting projects. So we thought, what if we fix all these problems and we make it just as simple as that work interface that you saw a minute ago? We make it just as simple as writing code and getting paid. Well, it turns out that even some of the best software engineers and designers and product managers want this. Even if you make $250,000 a year and you live in, you live in the San Francisco Bay Area, it's pretty tough to get by. Housing's extremely expensive. So in a single-income household, you know, you see a lot of people, even if they're Google engineers or Facebook engineers, wanting to do some work on the side. There's demand for an Uber for white-collar labor, so to speak, not just from the client side, which, of course, you all would love to just push a button and get access to great Stanford, MIT, Facebook talent or whatnot, but there's demand from their side, too. We didn't believe it at first, but it's, you know, we have a freelance network now of 1,000 people, and they're all from these logos. These are real people working with us. So a basic history of tool use to kind of set you up for the conversation on how we use tooling. So this little guy here, thousands of years ago, using this wrench on a rock for some reason, this is sort of tooling 1.0, where you know a human uses one tool to complete a task. As we've advanced through time, we've been able to create chains of tools. So in the second picture, we see somebody using a chain of tools to complete a task. So one tool makes the other tool more efficient or augments the other tool, et cetera, right? So moving into this third picture here, you see that the human becomes part of the tool chain. So the tools enhance the human enhances the tools, and vice versa. This is where Gigster wants to take the world, right? From kind of this pyramid to this, you know, man-in-the-loop system where humans can be augmented by tools. We call it making our freelancers superhuman. So then there's this other dystopian future here to the right where the machines remove us from the equation, which hopefully we don't get to. So why are machines interesting? Again, machines, and this is just the brand, you know, that robots or machines or AI or computers have, right? We all know that computers are reliable and efficient. How are they reliable? Well, computers pretty much do the same thing every single time, given the same set of instructions. You can't say the same thing for people. And machines are also more efficient, right? Machines, given the right set of inputs, can do very complex things very, very quickly. Now, there are a lot of tasks that computers can't completely replace, but there are repetitive tasks we do that can be replaced. For example, being a taxi dispatcher. That role has been replaced by Uber's central routing system. There's no dispatcher. There's no one sitting on a CB radio and a telephone that says, oh, hey, we've got somebody at 3rd and Bryant who needs a pickup, right? There are a lot of roles like this, particularly in middle management type areas, and then as you go down into other fields of knowledge work, that are amenable to this model. So essentially, we believe a couple different things which caused us to found this company and believe that artificial intelligence could have a meaningful impact on knowledge work. And if you believe these two, then you'll see where we're coming from. So number one, we believe that work is measurable by data. Number two, we believe that this work data has patterns. And number three, that these data patterns in the work data are exploitable to make work more reliable and more efficient. So drilling into each of these, work is measurable. What does this mean? Well, you've all used project management systems before, like Jira, Trello, Asana, Microsoft Project, things like that. All of these project management systems have APIs. So if a team of 10 or 20 people are working together in a project management system, I can make API calls to pull data out, and I can see what those people are doing. I can see the exact timestamps at which they completed work. I can see if, you know, John submitted work, and then Sally said that's not good enough and rejected the work. GitHub holds code. Whenever a developer checks code in, that's trackable. You can pull that out, and you can see, oh, you know, John was working last night until 5 in the morning. Bob has to check things in 10 times until they work. For communication, tools like Slack, Google, you know, Gmail, different email systems like that, Twilio, we're able to pull every single communication that happens across our network. So at Gigster, we build software. We deliver websites and mobile apps to our clients. And in the course of building software, you have to have a lot of conversations because software projects are complex. So every single phone call, every email, every text message, every Slack message that one of our project managers sends a client goes through a central system we have called the switchboard. So we actually record the calls, we record the SMSs and the emails and everything. Now we can learn over time how project managers communicate and how they answer different questions. And then design as well is actually measurable. Design is probably the final frontier for machines replacing work because, you know, as Crix mentioned in the previous presentation, when you have images and videos, you have much less structured data and you need billions of data points. But someday we'll get there with design as well. So work data has patterns. Let's look at a specific example of a work pattern that we can all agree is bad, okay? So Slack is a communication tool many of you have probably heard of where you can chat with your teammates. So we're looking at a graph of Slack communication over time. And let's say this is the developer talking to the project manager, or it's the developer talking to his colleague. So week one, we've got a lot of communication. Week two, also a lot. Week three, not so much. And week four and week five, it drops off. So somebody has dropped off the face of the map. Somebody's not communicating. Now we look at the number of days late the project is. This is obviously another data source we have. It's very easy to measure how late a project is, right? So we're not late. We're a little bit late, and then we start to linearly get more and more late over time. Now we also see this number that we should care about, which is customer satisfaction. So at Gigster, the customer gets to rate us every single week, which is very interesting because now we have weekly data points for every bit of knowledge work we've cranked out, and then we can correlate those with data points from other sources like Slack communication and days late. So you see that when we're late, the client gets unhappy, and this communication drops off, the satisfaction drops off to zero. So, you know, next time Slack communication drops off, we probably want to fix that problem before it has a ripple effect. So we have a system actually that does just that called the supervisor. And there's a lot of tools. I won't get into all of them, but this one's called the supervisor that has a little square for each project. We're doing about 200 right now that shows us anywhere from green to red, what's the health of this project based on a lot of those inputs that I showed you earlier. There are 50 different inputs into that at least, and we have thousands of data points for each one of those. And we're able to see for anything that's red, we should probably notify customer support and have customer support contact the freelancers, contact the client, basically fix the problem before the client gets upset, before the client even finds out. Because remember, this is supposed to be a black box that just delivers fantastic knowledge work no matter what. And as I said, this system's been working for us so far. So we're working on about 200 projects simultaneously right at this moment at an average size of $50,000. So these projects range from, you know, could be a simple design project that's $5,000 or $10,000, a small website for a nonprofit that's maybe $10,000 or $15,000, you know, all the way up to we're doing projects over $500,000 in scale that, you know, involve complex iOS apps, Android apps, websites, whatever it is. And my team is just 30 people. So this is physically impossible to do 200 projects times $50,000 worth of work with 30 people. So, this is where the freelance network and the artificial intelligence tools help us. I think it's pretty miraculous that we've been able to achieve this, particularly at the level of customer satisfaction we have right now, which is 9.3 out of 10 across all these projects. So a couple projects we've worked on. These are all real projects. So we've built software that powers a flying car. There is actually a flying car. I think there are one or two companies working on this. We've built a system that allows you to order from a robotic restaurant. This is actually a company that I'm advising in Silicon Valley. I work with a lot of companies. I work with about 50 or 60 companies as an investor and advisor up in Silicon Valley. These guys have built a robotic restaurant that makes hamburgers. Makes about 300 hamburgers an hour. It's the size of a van, and it kind of slices up the ingredients, and it cooks the burger to exactly the number of degrees you want. Anyways, we built some software to power that. We've built shopping recommendation apps for the likes of IBM. We actually built a demo for one of their conferences. We finished the app in 18 days using IBM Watson to recommend gifts for the holidays. This was back in December last year. We built a credit card visualization for, this was for MasterCard. So they have this 3D visualization of a globe in all of their lobbies around the world where they can see credit card transactions as spikes. And we built a lot of other things that are kind of on the more mundane end of the spectrum, like, you know, fantasy sports apps, social networks, et cetera. The services we're able to offer with this model are, we build mobile apps, websites, we do UI and UX design, but I would say where we truly specialize is if you need help with new technologies, that's where our freelancers tend to shine. They love using new technologies. These are, you know, highly paid senior engineers at top companies you've heard of who want to go home and learn about new technologies. So given the chance to get paid for it, they're thrilled to do that, you know, chance to get paid and work with great clients. So thank you very much. That's all I got.
And so if you want to think about platforms, something that Andreessen Horowitz is very bullish on, and if you think about platforms in terms of cars and you would consider Lyft, and if you're thinking about latent space, efficient space inside of homes. You would think about Airbnb, both of those being our investments as well. We see Gigster as in that same class, in that it's platformized a resource in software development and specifically leading edge technologies that are being consumed by enterprises now, like machine learning applications and like AI, as you've seen. And so we'll be out at the breakout session for some Q&A later on, and I'm hopeful that a lot of you will join us to ask both Crix and Roger questions about, you know, how these technologies can be utilized and employed inside of your businesses, especially in context of the fact that these are becoming not only a competitive advantage, but now even table stakes as far as understanding the feedback loop of your consumers that are going to be purchasing television shows and movies and streaming all of this content, and the ability to be able to learn about who these consumers are, where they are, and why they like what they like. And so thank you for your time this afternoon, and we do hope to see you again, as I said, in the Q&A. Thank you.
Thank you, Nathan. Thank you, Roger. Thank you, Crix. All right, we have one more session before we head to our breakout sessions and a little bit of a break. This is a real treat. Again, it's blending that whole human element in with data, in with digital, but also concentrating on startups and new companies and new technologies. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce the title of this session is The We Dynamic, Human Acceleration is the New Innovation. She's the godmother of Silicon Beach. She's also a founder of CoAccel. Miss Cam Kishani, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. Hi. Wait. Hello. Oh. This one?
Whatever you want. You can go handheld.
I can't see
anything. It's Digipalooza. Come on. It's rock and roll. And you can walk around with the handheld or feel free to stay
all
behind
right,
the podium.
Sounds good. Hi, everybody. How's it going? I'm the last talk of the day. So I promise it'll be brief and fun, kind of. my name's Cam Kishani, and I'm a human. I've also got some fancy titles. They call me the godmother of Silicon Beach. I'll explain what that means in a little bit. I'm an expert speaker at the United States State Department in a program proven to ward off extremism by empowering the women and the youth to build entrepreneurial projects and to assist in building out their ecosystem. I'm a three-time founder, advisor, and I strongly believe in immigration reform. So I'm on the Innovation Board Council at forward.us. I've worked globally with over 4,000 entrepreneurs and over 700 startups. I'm also a single mom to these lovely little dudes. I figure why sit here and talk about my accomplishments when I can't talk about the two biggest ones. My vision is humanity in business. There's a lack of humanity in business. It almost resembles a battlefield in some ways. It's a fear-ridden environment, and that's the antithesis of innovation. Innovation does not grow in a fearful environment. I believe that we can ultimately transform the economy, let alone businesses, to one that thrives off of the we dynamic as opposed to what it is now, the me dynamic. I'm the co-founder and partner at CoAccel, the first and only human accelerator. We believe that you are the ultimate product. Your work and innovations and whatever it is you create is simply an extension of you. So the more powerful and equipped you are, the more awesome the things you build will be and the things you create will be. What we have is a 3-month program that's one-on-one that accelerates you through your work. My business partner is a globally renowned intuitive coach, and she's worked with thousands of people all over the world, top senators and CEOs, with clients in 5 continents and a 99.9% accuracy rate. I've had Jasmine as my coach for the past 3.5 years, and now I have the honor of working with her. What we do is we build leaders because we believe that we can build people. We can empower one another, and in such a way that we inspire each other and collectively change the world. That's the fundamental essence of the We Dynamic. And this is what we do. This is our vision. This is our mission. Human acceleration, if you guys aren't familiar, don't worry. It's a term I created. It is the speed at which a human being is able to optimize their power and in turn manifest their happiness. Because at the end of the day, the work that we do and the lives that we live, we do to be happy. So now I'm going to tell you guys my story, because human acceleration spawned from my story. I always say all I've ever done is fail, which means all I do is grow. I never thought I was going to be an entrepreneur. I was bullied my whole life. I had a severely negative inner dialogue. You're not good enough, you're not smart enough, you're not pretty enough, you're not skinny enough. You can't do this, you'll fail. What if you fail? What if they judge you? You can't, what if, you can't, what if, you can't, what if. Enough to drive someone crazy. It's proven scientifically that we speak to ourselves worse than we do our biggest enemies. Now, I'm a product of a very successful family. So, of course, I was going to do what I had to do to be successful. My mom, my brother, my father, they're all doctors. My 8 uncles and my 2 aunts, they're doctors. 3/4 of my 40-something cousins are doctors. Talk about pressure, right? So, again, I did what I had to do to be successful. After college, my first job was as director of marketing for a medical diagnostics corporation. And I observed very robotic behavior when I began working there. Nobody knew why they were there. People didn't understand that they were in the business of patient care, that they were in the business of saving people's lives. It was a super negative environment. People would talk smack about each other right and left. I knew I couldn't function, let alone thrive in that, so I brought it up to the CEO at the ripe old age of 22, and I told him exactly what I just told you. I don't think people realize why they're here. He actually agreed. He held a meeting with the 60-plus employees, asked that question, and no one could answer it. So what I did was integrate the human element and the entire why in the marketing strategy, and we ended up increasing profits 60% throughout the 4 years that I was there. I believe in people and profit. We went from 3 locations to 9, and the company ended up getting acquired 2 years after I left. And I left because I craved autonomy. And I had a great idea, or so I thought, to start my own startup. It was me and my co-founder. It was during the height of the economic recession. Great timing, right? And we put ourselves in a little hole, took 2 years, $200,000, and we ended up with 3 customers. It was a brutal failure. And it was really, really, really hard to bounce back from. I tried looking for a job. I couldn't find any. It was, at the height of the economic recession. I had my MBA, and all I could find was secretarial jobs for like 30 grand a year. I'm good. So from that scarcity spawned creativity, and we created Coloft. Coloft was the first co-working space in Los Angeles back in early 2010. For entrepreneurs, technology entrepreneurs, and startups. During the 4 years that I was there, we had over 1,800 alumni, over 700 startups. This includes Fullscreen, Instacart, Uber LA, and the early Tinder team, amongst many more. So Coloft was built with a community first, the profit will come mentality, and it did. We broke even in 4 months, And we ended up creating and spawning the entire Silicon Beach ecosystem that you now know about, and this is why they call me the godmother. So it's amazing what awesome results will come from applying the we dynamic. Now, my co-founder was my ex-husband. So 4 years into this, when I filed for divorce, he fired me from my own company. Lesson learned, everything in writing, guys. Now, that moment was a really difficult one for me. I was completely stripped naked in the universe. Everything that I thought I was, I no longer was. I was that guy's wife for 12 years, and I wasn't anymore. I was Koloff Cam, and I wasn't anymore. Who am I? All of a sudden, I am a single mom, no income, and I had no idea what to do. I was deathly afraid. So I went into a deep depression. And during this time, I was really, really blessed to have had Jasmine come into my life, my business partner. She's the only one who didn't judge me. She's the only one who really saw me. She's the only one that truly believed in me. And she's the only one that gave me hope. And with her incredible gift, she was able to really get the fear out of me. She helped build me back up. And in such a way that within an 8-month period from when my divorce finalized, I was working with the State Department. And I was influencing the ambassadors, working with royalty, and working with the women and the youth out there and helping them to create entrepreneurial projects in the Middle East. Now, the reason I share my story with you guys is not only because I'm a product, well, it is because of that, actually. It's because I'm a product of human acceleration. The girl who historically put the power outside of herself, the girl who historically put the value of herself and her worth and anything and everything that she thought she was in titles, in jobs, in relationships, the girl who was silent and scared is now the woman standing in front of you. I got a loud voice, no longer silent, no longer scared. And I want to bring this to everyone because I believe that everyone should have the accessibility to understand what they're actually capable of. So I created this little, spelling error. It's supposed to say once, not one. Humans are attached to outcomes. Once I get X, I will become insert state of being. Once I lose 10 pounds, I'll become happy. Once I get married, I'll be happy. Once I have children, I'll be happy. Once I make $1 billion, I'll be happy. Once I get that job, I'll be happy. You're never gonna be happy. When you're chasing anything, it chases you. Happiness is within us, and we can choose to be happy at all times. It doesn't have to be dependent on a variable. The only thing in this world of variables that is constant is us. Human acceleration is the new innovation. Technology is awesome. Innovation is awesome. Things are moving really, really quickly. Really quickly. It's almost hard to process. We're all on info overload. With the amount of stuff out there, it's hard to look at something more than 2 seconds. But by putting the power outside of ourselves and claiming that technology and innovation is the way to innovate, I believe is a fallacy. The truth is that innovation is within us. Humans are the ones that create great ideas, not machines. We are human. We are not machines. And the only way to be able to constantly innovate is to flip the energy that we're investing into the technology and innovation and redirect that energy and focus on us and invest in ourselves to really be able to create happiness, first of all, and innovation. Once we accelerate ourselves, we embrace growth and change. And fundamentally, almost without effort, we're able to live freely. And we understand that the only thing that is constant is change. We grow into the purpose-driven beings that we are created to be. And we see beyond ourselves. We'll see one another. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Cam. Awesome personal story. Brought it all back. Brought back to the human element. Okay. So now it's going to get a little nutty. Okay, because we're going to the breakout sessions. The breakout sessions are across the hall. The food, the coffee, the cookies, they're all in those breakout sessions in here. We have two rooms. Room A is on the right. It's the cast and crew breakout. Do I have a breakout slide here? That's all right. I'm just gonna quickly explain. Room B is over here on the left. But what we need to do is clear this entire room, because this was kind of meant to be the bridge as well into the next group that's coming in from 4 to 6. It's the SoCal Women's Leadership Summit. So there's a bunch of people out in the hallway. It's going to be a little crazy. We're going to start these breakouts on time at 4:30. So if you would kindly shift over there, and essentially we're going to end at 5:30 when those breakout sessions end with a cocktail reception in the hallway. Thank you so much to everybody for today. What a great thank you to our sponsors, Cast and Crew, Gray Meta, Teradata, Microsoft Azure, Okta, FilmTrack, Zazu, and Datamere. And thank you all for spending the day here with us at HITS.